The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest today is Michael Collier, who will introduce himself with an opening poem.
Argos. If you think Odysseus too strong and brave to cry, that the God-loved, God-protected hero, when he returned to Ithaca disguised, intent to check up on his wife and candidly apprise the condition of his kingdom, steeled himself resolutely against surprise, and came into his land cold-hearted, clear-eyed, ready for revenge. Then you read Homer as I did, too fast, knowing you'd be tested for plot and major happenings, skimming forward to the massacre, the shambles engineered with Telemachus by turning beggar and taking up the challenge of the bow. Reading this way, you probably missed the tear Odysseus shed for his decrepit dog, Argos, who's nothing but a bag of bones asleep atop a refuse pile outside the palace gates. The dog is not a god in earthly clothes, but in its own disguise of death and destitution is more like Ithaca itself. And if you returned home after 20 years, you might weep for the dog you long ago abandoned, rising from the garbage of its bed, its instinct of recognition still intact, enough will to wag its tail, lift its head, but little more. Years ago, you had the chance to read that page more closely, but instead you raced ahead like Odysseus, cocksure with your plan. Now the past is what you study, where guile and speed give over to grief, so you might stop, and desiring to weep, weep more deeply.
That is the voice of Michael Collier. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. Michael has been the director of the Breadloaf Writers Conference, I say 8 years.
Ten. Yes.
Unbelievable.
It is.
And has taught English at the University of Maryland. I believe you're directing the graduate writers program.
I co-direct it with Stanley Plumley, yes.
Yes. And you also are the author of several books of poetry, The Clasp, The Folded Heart, The Neighbor. I know you have won the Guggenheim, the NEA, that's the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Discovery, the Nation Award, among many, many others. And today we're going to focus on you and your career and your life and your secrets and especially your work. And when I hear that work that you opened with, it ratifies my knowledge of you, which is that you are a poet of story. And where other poets might depend on utterance or experimental language or meditation, you always have a story. Can you tell me what you think is the importance of that in poetry and in your own work?
Well, there are probably two things that it suggests. One is I started writing fiction very early on and wrote a lot of it, a lot of which wasn't very good. And at some point, I was writing poems at the same time, but at some point, I think I found that my temperament was more that, let's say, of a sprinter rather than a long-distance runner. And I found that I was writing poems that had stories in them. So that's one aspect of it. I also think that writing stories in poems or finding stories in poems was a way of finding out what my experience was about and being able to locate it. I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, and in a household where there weren't many books, hardly any books at all, but reading was encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really thought, once I started to write, I never really thought that there was much in my childhood that I would write about, because it was unremarkable, to say the least. But about 15 years ago, I found myself writing poems about the neighbors that I grew up with.
You certainly did.
And
I would like to say that I kept thinking as I read and reread that book that you went through life with a security camera and didn't know it because of the things that you have brought to adulthood. I'm glad I didn't live on your street. I mean, every lawnmower was remembered, every quirk, every little facet of life.
Well, it's odd how you don't realize what you're taking in. And I think that childhood has a way of making it sharper and more acute. But I also think that as adults we take in things that we don't quite realize as well. And but I think as children we become practiced at it without even really knowing. It's like acquiring language.
But I think you could actually, and we could all do this as a test to find material. We could go down the street and go in each house and get a poem, even today. I think that we could just literally go through the floors of our building and find the guy fixing his lawnmower, and each of your worlds has a resonance. They're not just small pieces of machinery in the yard. So are you going to read us something?
Yeah, I think probably the best thing to do is to read one of these poems.
This is Michael Kaw. You're talking. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
This is called The Barber, and I think it was the first poem about my neighbors that I started to write. And then after that, they began to kind of present themselves randomly, and I just kept writing poems about them. The barber. Even in death, he roams the yard in his boxer shorts, plowing the push mower through Bermuda grass, bowling it against the fence and tree trunks, chipping its twisted blades on the patio's edge. The chalky flint and orange spark of struck concrete floats in the air, tastes like metal, smells like the slow burn of hair on his electric clippers. And smelling it, I feel the hot shoe of the shaver as he guided it in a high arc around my ears, then set the sharp, toothy edge against my sideburns to trim them square. And how he used his huge stomach to butt the chair and his flat hand palming my head to keep me still, pressing my chin down as he cleaned the ragged wisps of hair along my neck. A fat, inconsolable man whose skill and pleasure was to clip and shear, to make raw and stubble all that grew in this world, expose the scalp, the place of roots and nerves, and make vulnerable there in the double mirrors of his shop the long stem muscles of our necks. And so we hung below his license in its cheap black frame, above the violet light of the scissors shed with its glass jars of germicide and the long tapered combs soaking in its blue iridescence. Gruff, when he wasn't silent, he was a neighbor to fear. Yet we trusted him beyond his anger, beyond his privacy. He was like a father we could hate, a foil for our unspent vengeance, though vengeance was always his. He sent us back into the world, burning and itching, alive with the horror of closing eyes in the pinkish darkness of his shop, and having felt the horsehair brush, talc-filled, cloying, too sweet for boyhood, whisked across the face.
I love that last line, too sweet for boyhood. Such a sinister event.
Well, I always thought that the barbershops were particularly strange because you usually had large men doing this very delicate work with these little scissors. And then there was this act at the end. That you were perfumed.
Wonderful. I wonder where that came to you when you were writing the poem. That talcum powder at the end of the event, we got it. So at the end of the poem, was it a natural thing for you to remember?
I think so. To tell you the truth, I can't really remember about how I arrived at the end of the poem, although reading it, I think probably there was a great sense of relief that I found this exit image, let's say, for the poem.
And how the adult is always alien to the child.
Right.
And how we interpret even a quick movement as a maybe a brusque or cruel movement. But I love that you could make him the symbol for anger.
Well, going to a barbershop was a little bit different for me because I was brought up in a household of women. I have four sisters, and my father was a traveling salesman. So he would be gone for a week, 2 weeks at a time, that sort of thing. And I can remember going to the barbershop with him and feeling as if I was in a world that was very strange. I think other people growing up, other young men growing up, would have felt the barbershop not to be
but a boy
so
thing.
Strange.
It was such a boy thing to go with your father.
Yep.
Michael Collier is our poet. He is now the Poet Laureate of Maryland, as well as many other things. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're at the Library of Congress, and we would not like to be anywhere else today. You are also putting together some anthologies in your spare time. I know of one. I think there are three by now, right?
Yes, I've edited three anthologies. About 10 years ago, maybe a little longer now, I did an anthology that collected poems that were in books that the Wesleyan University Press published in its poetry series. And since then, I've done two anthologies that are published through the Breadloaf Writers Conference.
And we will explore what you do there after we hear another poem, because poetry is why we came. For that I came. Yeats said it first, and Adrienne Rich said it second. I don't mind saying it third.
Well, it bears repeating, doesn't it? This is a poem called The Wave, and I wrote it after the so-called Gulf War was winding down. The Wave. Vendors with racks of soft drinks, pallets of cotton candy, ice cream in bright insulated bags, pretzels in metal cabinets, and the peanut man with his yellow peanut earring. Money folded between fingers, spokes of green waving in the glad pandemonium greeting the bud man with his quick-pouring mechanism strapped to his wrist like a prosthesis. Or the hot dog guy genuflecting in the steep aisles, anointing the roll and weenie with mustard before passing it down to the fat kid sitting between skinny parents. In the air above us, the flittering birds, attracted and repelled by planetary field lights, swoop in ecstatic arcs, trapped under a dark, invisible dome. The park organ, the jumbotron, the mascot pacing atop the visitor's dugout, taunting them with oversized antics, while the groundskeepers mist the infield with the fire hose, leavening the calm, raked earth. Later, in the fifth or sixth, two soldiers sitting next to me, who have paced each other with a beer an inning and kept their buzz buffed with the flask, take off their shirts, though the night's cool, and move to the front row, where they face the crowd, sweep up their arms, and command us to rise from our seats. At first, only a few respond. But like molecules quickening, or cells dividing, or herds stampeding, we coalesce, orison provoking unison, section by section, as if township by township, our standing up and sitting down becomes the Simon Says and Mother May I of a nation, as it runs through our rippling, shimmering, upraised hands that form the crest of a wave built on the urges and urgings of the soldiers whose skin is slick with sweat or some other labor, and whose goal now, for all of us, for themselves, for the players on the field, is simply to stay in the wave, to keep it going for as long as they can.
That is one of your most musical poems, and I think you may know that. It is something you couldn't have contrived, but it must be the way the spirit knows vowels or something. But it is the repetition of sound and lyricism within a line, which is a rather conforming line. Mm-hmm. Your form is just that. Mm-hmm. It's form. You don't take any chances. Are not any lumps under the mattress. But if you want to analyze that, the music compressed there is really from consonant and vowels. It is so interesting. Slick, slah, slah. And then the riding the long vowels.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. And you probably weren't aware when you wrote it.
Well, it was a poem I was struggling to, that I really wrestled with, because I had started off writing a different kind of poem. And that's one of the things I think that happens quite a bit. You start writing about some different aspect of the subject, particularly for this poem. I had been taking the train between New Haven, Connecticut and Baltimore for a number of years.
I remember.
Commuting, really. And as I say, it was after the Gulf War, and there were lots of soldiers on those trains then, and they were getting on and off at different stops. And I think it was in Delaware, in Wilmington, there was a soldier who got off the train. He was getting his duffel bag down from the rack overhead, and an elderly man got up to try and help him. And it occurred to me in that, and the elderly man said, "I'm glad you're okay, I'm glad you're back." And I realized that that was a kind of meeting of, let's say, a veteran probably, a man who is my father's age. My father was a veteran in the Second World War. And that this is the kind of meeting that had been happening for thousands of years
between the wave,
the older soldier. And so I tried to write a poem about that meeting. And I think quite often what happens with poems, if you move too directly in a particular direction, you're apt not to discover anything. And it becomes a dead end. It's not interesting. So I struggle with this poem, and perhaps it is more the sound that then weaned me away from that initial story or subject. And
you got lost.
I found
a better poem.
Yeah, and that's the hope. you hope to get lost every time.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're talking to poet Michael Collier. You have won a lot of things, Michael. And when I went into the internet to try to find you, it was such a cloud I couldn't enter, because you had so many listings, and they were so befuddling. But I do know some things. You went to Connecticut College and the University of Arizona, where you got your Master's of Fine Arts. You have been a traveler to Northern Africa, Siberia, and Japan. You've been many things, and it is said even a house painter, a community activist, a poet. You are at the English Department of the University of Maryland at College Park at this time, and you are the director of Breadloaf. And I actually interviewed you the month before you went, and I said, how's it going? And you said, well, I'm not sleeping as well as I used to. And then I saw you later, and you said, you know what? I'm just fine. So somehow that you overcame this huge task given to you, becoming the director of one of the most venerable institutions in America, one of the longest standing conferences. I followed it since John Chardy was there. Mm-hmm. And so maybe you'll just tell our audience in a couple of sentences what Breadloaf is and what you do.
Well, Breadloaf is an annual writers' conference that's held more or less the last 2 weeks of August in Vermont, about 20 minutes outside of Middlebury, up in the Green Mountains. It's an absolutely stunningly beautiful site. And there are about 250 people who come together. We have workshops in fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. There are 10 people in each workshop. It's conference lasts about 11 days, and we have, besides the workshops, we have readings and lectures and classes. We have special guests who come, and it's a very, very intense environment. There are very few people who go up there or don't come away, one, completely exhausted, and also invigorated and encouraged. And I also like to think go on to do the work that they really imagined that they would do, not so much because Breadloaf made it happen for them, but perhaps because it gave them the kind of encouragement they needed to keep working or think about their writing in a slightly different way.
Well, that on the abstract level, that is absolutely true. But then in the trenches, there's somebody that has to make all that happen. And well, I know what it takes and how you have to choose people and what decisions you have to make. And the buck stops there. You're the director.
Well, fortunately, I work with some really wonderful people. And
And how much does the college enter into that, Middlebury?
Well, it is a Middlebury College program, and they're completely behind it. It couldn't run without them. So it enters in.
They help.
Quite a bit. Mm-hmm. No, they're completely supportive of
it. You go up a week ahead, or?
No, I go up a couple days ahead, but because right before that, the 6 weeks preceding that, there's another Breadloaf program, which is quite often confused with our program, but they're separate, and that's the Breadloaf School of English. And the Breadloaf School of English is a wonderful Master of Arts program for the study of American and English literature and drama. And so their graduation happens 3 days before the conference starts, so I can't really go up much earlier than that.
Well, it is good to know that you are there. I always feel good knowing you're there.
Oh, well,
it's
thank
had a,
you.
A very a weird past. I mean, it used to be the books you read about it. You know, in the beginning, it was like hijinks and lots of scotch, and things have become very professional since.
Well, I think what happens is any institution like that sort of reflects more or less what's going on in the culture at a given time, I think.
That's true. The 50s were rollicking.
The 50s were rollicking, and the 60s and 70s were...
cultural revolutions.
Yeah. And I think some of that dust was still swirling around through the 80s and into the early 90s. Whenever you get 250 people together away from their homes and they're intensively involved in something like writing and art, there's a lot of energy that gets going.
Mm.
And so...
you give scholarships?
We have lots of scholarships, yeah.
Yep. So how does that... the bottom line, how come you're not in the red? Because I never see anyone who's paying for it.
Oh, no. We have quite a few people who pay.
You can pay, but you have to still be chosen.
Yes.
There's a selection process.
Yes. We have about 1,200 applications, and from that, 200 people are selected. But the larger share of the applications are people applying for financial aid. But nevertheless, I think it's about, you know, a quarter get into the conference.
That's like a Guggenheim. Is it the same percentage? About 3,000 are applying, about 300 get it.
It is very competitive, and depending on what scholarship you're applying to, it's even more competitive.
We are here to hear you, and that's what I'm going to force you to do. What book are you going to read now?
Well, I think I'll read a poem from The Ledge, which is what I've been reading from, except The Barber was from that book called The Neighbor. And I think I'll read a poem called My Crucifixion. This poem involves my sisters, although they may not like to be reminded of this. Not blasphemy, so much as curiosity and imitation suggested I lie face up and naked on my bedroom floor, arms stretched out like his, feet crossed at the ankles, in my head lolling in that familiar, defeated way. While my sisters worked with toy wooden hammers to drive imagined spikes through my hands and feet. A spiritual exercise? I don't think so. For unlike Christ, my boy-sized penis stiffened like one of Satan's fingers. I was dying a Savior's death, and yet what my sisters called my thing struggled against extinction, as if its resurrection could not be held off by this playful, holy torture, nor stopped except by the arrival of my parents, who stood above us suddenly like prelates, home early from their supper club, stunned but not astonished to find the babysitter asleep and the inquisitive nature of our heathenish hearts amuck in murderous pageantry.
From The Ledge, Michael Collier. You actually had a Catholic education.
I had a very traditional Catholic education, and beyond the elementary school I went to, I then went to a Jesuit high school, and then for 1 year I went to a Jesuit university. So I had an extended and extensive Catholic education.
I always am looking for connections from that into your work, as I do with Billy Collins, and I feel it shows. There is something that shows.
Well, I think part of what shows, I won't speak for Billy Collins, but I feel it. I don't know that it shows literally, but there's something about the ritual of a poem that, for me, that also is connected to the drama of liturgy.
Exactly.
So right from the very beginning, as a little kid, I was always watching some drama unfolding, albeit it was one that was repeated. Nevertheless, I think there's a connection there. And then I also think, too, the singing that, you know, I had to do, and all my classmates had to do, anybody who had a Catholic education had to do, the kind of singing that we did in church fills you up with music. And then also to get back to the notion of liturgy, the Gregorian chant, the priest even speaking the vernacular, it was chanted in a way. There was a rhythm to the language, and I think that has an effect.
Absolutely.
If you're listening to it and you're somehow prone to absorbing it, I think that those are the kinds of connections rather than, at least for me, rather than ones of moral principle or ideas about or ethical
or
ideas.
Or content even. Your content does not reflect it, but the music does. And actually, Billy Collins says the same. Were you old enough to have Latin masses?
Yeah, yes. And I was an altar boy until I was 18. And we learned the Latin Mass. Yes, I learned
see
the Latin
that
mass.
As significant. Yeah. I do. And the pageantry, I definitely feel that is there. It's all there underneath the line. Yeah.
I think it's just a way of constantly seeing events ordered in a dramatic way.
Which is what a poem is.
Well, which is my idea of a poem, yes.
And what is the bigger idea of what a poem is? There's a lot of question about whether the creative writing programs really are doing much good, or they're doing too much good, or we have too many poets or too little poets. I have my own feelings about that. But since you teach in them, and I do too, you have to have an argument that must be in favor.
Well, first of all, I think our outcomes-obsessed society makes us ask these kinds of questions. Are the creative writing programs doing any good? And I guess what you have to then ask yourself is, what do you mean by good? If creative writing programs are keeping alive poetry in the culture by training readers as much as writers, then I think that they're doing a tremendous amount of good. If you think that good is making writers sort of fit a kind of form, then that's probably not so good.
That doesn't happen.
It does.
Where?
What does happen is this, I think, and it's happened everywhere in any kind of art. There are modes in which people write in, and writers who I think aren't quite as sophisticated, or perhaps don't have the passion and perseverance to really develop something that has their own signature on it, they may find themselves sounding more like each other than not. That happens.
Can you smell a University of Iowa writer? Okay, and hot? No, I cannot.
Not really, no.
No. And we, at where I've been in St. Mary's College for 20 years, Michael Glazier, a wonderful director, likes the students to apprentice to a poet as they do at Johns Hopkins writing seminars. I really protested that would be, I really was furious because I wanted the voice. Uh-huh. And they always came out with their own voices.
Yeah.
Always.
Absolutely. The fact is that it's always going to sound different than
we
who
shouldn't
you're trying
be
to
worried.
Imitate.
We shouldn't be so worried. And what interests me more than anything is the question itself. Creative writing programs. What, you know, a boil on this country's skin. Uh-huh. That is such an interesting quarrel, isn't it?
Well, I think there is an old quarrel about whether or not you can teach anything that has to do with the arts.
Yeah, always.
But it gets particularly hot around writing and poetry. But no one really argues that you can't teach someone how to play the violin or dance. Or even paint.
But writing takes the courage beyond form that those others do not take, because I can dance without telling the truth about my childhood, but I can't write a poem without it, without the self.
I'm not sure about that, to tell you the truth. I'm not sure that I would agree with that. I think in all those arts, you have to be in touch with that thing that takes you really out of yourself.
We can call it the self.
I don't mind calling
Frank
it the
Frank Bedard has made a meal out of explaining how the self is in the poem.
Yeah, I don't, that doesn't bother.
So you say that it is evident, more than in writing.
I think so. I think one of the reasons we get hung up on writing is that we all have language. It's mysterious. We don't know how we got it. There it is. We were taught how to write, more or less. And so we all think that we have this ability that because we have writing, we should just be able to sit down and write a poem. But poems use language as a kind of medium, the same way that painters use color and line as a medium. And so you can't expect yourself just to sit down and write a poem.
Because you knew Jane saw a spot in the first grade.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I know that people must love you in the classroom, and I think they should sign up. Hey, it's open, right? All they have to do is qualify at the University of Maryland. They
yes.
have to have an undergraduate degree. They have
right.
to want an MFA in creative writing, and they just have to throw their hat in the ring, and they
we
might get
have,
Michael.
We also have a wonderful undergraduate program as well.
Ah, that's right. That is
quite
right.
We have a
terrific
undergraduate program.
Michael Collier is his name. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are at the Library of Congress. We love the Library of Congress. It has thousands of tapes of poets, and it is the country's memory in this building. I'm going to ask you to read another poem.
Okay. I think what I'd like to do is read some poems that I've been working on, some more recent poems, and I'll read this one first. Actually, the poems I've been writing recently, although this will belie that, it won't seem like that at all, aren't quite as narrative. But here's a little narrative that I've worked on. It's called The Lift. Bird song in the morning air, but also the whir of my neighbor's lift as it raises him in his wheelchair onto the bed of his truck. Not someone to pity. He locks the wheels in place and, like a gymnast on parallel bars, manages himself from his seat and then, in a move too quick to see, disappears. Though because I've been there beside him, I know he's on all fours crawling to the tailgate where he swings over the edge and continues in the dirt of the drive. Sometimes when I'm in the yard pulling weeds or admiring sunlight through leaves, the electric whir of the lift, followed by its silence, breaks through. And then the hoof slap of palms on the ground, the scrape of shoes pulled along by his strength. And I see him as I did the first time, hoisting a chainsaw by block and tackle, and then himself into the blighted tree towering between our yards, and which, limb by limb, branch and trunk, he cut down and stacked.
If you aren't the king of machinery, nobody is. I mean, you have V8 engines, you have lifts, you have pulleys, you have lawnmowers, you have every detritus of the human existence.
I like
you
gizmos.
Are the Robert Pinsky of the machine. Yes, you do. And not only that, you tell us the history of America. And with your little machines in other people's backyards.
Well, I suppose the history of America has a lot to do with machines in people's front and backyards.
In your lifetime, yes. I'm sure you've thought about this. But you really do use mechanical things in an existential way.
Well, no, I've thought a lot about it. And there's a wonderful poem by Elizabeth Bishop called The Fish. It's very famous. In fact, she grew to hate the idea of this poem because it was reprinted so many places, but I think it's a marvelous 20th century poem. And in that poem, she looks at this fish that she's caught and reports on it in such a vivid way that almost right in the middle of the poem, as she's looking at it, it changes into something else. And she even asks, is it, if you could call it a jaw, when she's looking at the fish's jaw. It almost becomes something else. I remember when I read that poem years and years ago, I thought, well, that's really interesting. If you just stick with the object for as long as possible, it's going to lead you someplace. And I think that that's a kind of simple-minded idea.
I think it's very profound, actually. It's about the art of seeing.
I guess I just believe in it.
I do. And I see it in your work, yes, where you even become the knife and the water and the fish.
Yeah, it's something I'm still attracted to.
Let's hear some more.
Okay, this is a more recent poem as well. It's called Bardo. And for Tibetan Buddhists, Bardo is a realm after death in which you move around in looking for your next life. And my father-in-law was a Tibetan Buddhist, a long practicing Tibetan Buddhist. And this is a poem that really has to do with his death. And there's a little squib here from a Tom Gunn poem, Bardo. A dark, wide realm where we walk with everyone. Dangerously frail is what his hand was like when he showed up at our house 3 or 4 days after his death and stood at the foot of our bed. Though we had expected him to appear in some form, it was odd, the clarity and precise decrepitude of his condition, and how his hand, frail as it was, lifted me from behind my head up from the pillow, so that no longer could I claim it was a dream, nor deny that what your father wanted, even with you sleeping next to me, was to kiss me on the lips. There was no refusing his anointing me with what I was meant to bear of him from where he was, present in the world, a document loose from the archives of form. Not spectral, not corporeal, in transit, though not between lives or bodies. Those lips on mine, then mine on yours.
What is this new book going to be called?
I don't know what it's going to be called, but it's perplexing in the sense that most of the poems seem to be elegiac, and I have tons of birds. But it's still too soon to panic. Mm-hmm. I may be able to make something out of it yet.
It looks like you have a lot.
No, I don't have a lot, but if I have a couple more years, I'll probably have another book finished.
It takes you a long time.
I do write very, very, very slowly. That poem, the first poem I read, Argos, I had started writing actually in 1983, and then I finished it in 98.
But the better for it, because that's a complicated poem.
Well, for a poem like that, I just hadn't lived long enough. I didn't have the experience I needed in order to know where it was I had started.
So it would be interesting to see the first draft of that. You might just have told the story. And then you got to the story within the story, maybe.
Well, with that poem, it was a long process, but I can imagine that that's probably true.
What is the energetics of your writing, if that's a word? What are the energetics? What does move you? How do you start? How do you think?
Mostly it's the tortoise approach. It's very slow, but usually what happens is I'll see something or I'll get entranced by a word. When I was describing the genesis of the wave, that's a typical way a poem will happen, and typical as well that the poem ended up being about something different. But with the generating story somehow informing it.
Always story.
But quiet, something private, something that I would know and no one else would know.
Edward Hirsch says, elegant, clear-eyed, unflinching, the ledge probes the depths and radiates a darkly luminous human splendor. And I think those are three words there that I would say: elegant, radiate, splendor. And you have many remarks about your work, and all of them are true. Illuminates. I think the elegant spiritual tone of the work is something we all agree on about your work. And I think it was there from the beginning. I think I saw early things of yours. And it is a deeply, it's a crystalline sureness of respect for the poem, I guess it is. You know, you're just not going to mess around and just slop something on the page.
Well, I guess one thing, too, although this is old-fashioned in a way, but I do think that there is a connection between the word, between language and the world, and that part of the interesting work that any artist does is to try and negotiate that. You want to keep it fluid and flexible, but at the same time, I think that there are connections between language and the world. It's not one-on-one, but it does lead you back and forth.
And A.R. Ammon said, is a kind of behavior. Poetry is a kind of behavior. And sometimes I have not behaved so well, and I'm not so proud of it. But you don't do too much wrong.
No, I think also, I like that idea, it's a kind of behavior. It's also a habit. Not just a habit of thinking, but a kind of habit of being. In other words, your experience is constantly getting translated through a way over many, many years that you've been handling language. Yeah. Let me read one of these bird poems, or maybe even at least one of these. This is called Common Flicker. Old nail pounding your way into bark or creosote. Intermittent tripod of legs and beak, derrick, larvae driller. When I look up from my mind, I see what you are. Feather-hooded, mustached, gripped to the steady perch. The idea of the lower altitude sparged with color, a tuber of claws and wings and an eye unmarred. Wing-handled hammer, packing the framer's blow, face stropping the hardness, drumming and drumming, your song is your name. This will cure me, you declare. This will heal the fractured jaw, soothe the vibrating helve, so I can eat, so I can sing. So you see, these are kind of elegiac. And I did also want to read one that is a kind of elegy.
How can something be a kind of elegy?
Well, you'll see I make fun of the idea of it, so that's why I say a kind of elegy. It's called Angry Elegy for a Long-Dead Friend. Last night when you appeared, you brought the sacks of shoes and folded clothes that stood waiting in your garage for someone else to remove the day you died. Because you were laid out at the corners when I arrived, you couldn't know what I saw. Boots and sneakers, sandals jammed in grocery bags, shirts and pants no longer stylish. Months before, what was it you said? Don't come around here again? So why these visits? Why the burden of this evidence? And silent as you are, does your presence beg forgiveness? There was also, you should know, a flat tire that gave your car a slouched, defeated look. I saw it before I saw the discards. In Dante's hell, the souls spend their time repaying themselves with their own sins. He witnessed their anguish, but was rarely moved. And Virgil, never. Next time you visit, bring that tire, wear it like a necklace, and we'll set it on fire.
There's very little anger in your poems, except, well, there is a coal that burns. You have actually a nice coal burning in one of your poems. And there is a smoldering beneath some of them. There is, however, somebody who threw a glass of vodka in your face and you had a beer bottle in your hand, unless that you were reporting somebody else. And you almost threw a beer bottle. Now, I'd love to know who that was.
It's in the poem. Yes, it is.
But whether that happened or not.
Well, whether that happened or a version of it happened, but it is in the poem, yeah.
It's so unlike anything you've ever done. Someone holding your arms and taking you outside from the kitchen. I thought, wow, this Michael, you don't know everything about him. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and that is Michael Collier. We're hearing the very, very special treat of having new poetry premiere today on microphone, and I'd like to go on with that.
Sure, great. This is an elegy, and it's for Aga Shahid Ali, who died a few years ago. He's a wonderful Kashmiri American poet. It's called Bird Crashing Into Window. In cartoons, they do it and then get up. A carousel of stars, asterisks, and question marks trapped in a caption bubble above a dizzy, flattened head that pops back into shape. But this one collapsed in its skirt of red feathers, and now its head hangs like a closed hinge, and its beak, a yellow dart, is stuck in the gray porch floor and seems transformed forever. A broken gadget, a heavy shuttlecock. And yet it's not all dead. The breast palpitates, the bent legs scrabble, and its eye, the one that can't turn away, fish egg black, stares and blinks. Behind me, sitting in a chair, his head resting in a pillow, a friend recites Lycidas to prove it's not the tumor or the treatment that's wasted what his memory captured years ago in school. Never mind he drops more than a line or two. It's not a lean and flashy tune he sings, though that's what he'd prefer. His hair wispy, his head misshapen. Beyond the window, the wind shakes down the dogwood petals. Beetles drown in sap, and bees paint themselves with pollen. Get up, fly away, my caption urges. Get up if you can.
Nice caption.
Yeah.
You think these are very different from your first poems?
No, it's really hard to say. I think they feel different, but I think one of the things that informs poems that make them feel different is the experience that you're writing out of, which I think has to be different. Even for those poets who go back to certain events again and again, they're coming back to them. They're coming back to those events
from a different place.
Slightly. So I think that even if you're not working the materials slightly differently, although I think I am, what is different is the experience informing them, and that is a more powerful part of the equation, I think. And I think it's also one of the things that poets can fool themselves by thinking they're writing different poems by just trying to do something stylistically different. Mm. It's like changing clothes. I remember many years ago, Philip Levine said something to me that I've always carried with me. And it was after my first book had been published. In fact, I was at Breadloaf then, and he was a teacher, and I was in his workshop. And I said, you know, I'm impatient to do something different. I want to write a different kind of poem. And he looked at me, he said, well, that's fine, but the way you write different kinds of poems is by having different kinds of experience. In other words, you can't just will yourself to write a different kind of poem. The poem is intimately connected to how you see the world, what you're experiencing at the time. And I try and tell students that.
I see, though, your approaches are more varied in this particular manuscript. Just the entry to the poem is just a little something you have never done before. The caption, the cartoon,
right.
You never started. And you have a poem about sparrows. You do have other poems about birds, but these are all treated very differently. So that's absolutely supporting what you're saying. Mm. You're just coming at life very at a different angle.
These poems are different too in the sense that I don't have much say in either summoning them or in some ways or even writing them. They're shorter. The Bird Crashing Into Window is a poem I worked in a way that is familiar to me. But that Common Flicker poem was a poem that just is completely working off the language and the sound, and has very little to do with anecdote and story.
That's
and
true.
Many of the poems are like that. They feel more lyrical in a way.
You've been doing it long enough that I guess it could even be easier sometimes.
No, it's harder.
Is it harder?
It's harder.
Well, every time you sit down, you don't know how to write a poem, let's face it.
It is a bit like that, yeah.
However, your hand is practiced. You have a smooth hand, and I do think there's something about being a seasoned poet that makes the craft less clunky.
Well, that's probably true. I guess what I was thinking about is that the poems don't come as easily as they used to, and there are lots of reasons for that. One is having a very busy life right now, and the other is I'm probably doing a lot of pre-editing before I even put anything down. I'm thinking
that's bad. That's bad.
Could be bad.
Because, well, it's a form of revision then. You're just doing it first.
Well,
I'm so afraid of the judgment. That's the only trouble.
Well, the judgment isn't being made on the page. It's being made up in the head, and you're working things around. But I think, and as I said, I think that kind of work is being done also because of the kind of life I'm leading right now as well, which is very busy and sort of compartmentalized.
It would never be less, though. So we just might as well find, you know, that hour a day.
You have to give yourself over to some time, whether it's reading or writing. You have to be in the presence of poetry. I believe that thoroughly.
This is The Poet and the Poem. We are in the presence of poetry, and I love it. That's Michael Collier talking, and I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're going to hear a couple final poems.
This is called Turkey Vulture. The red drill of their faces, pink-tipped, grubbed in gore, cyclopean in their hunger for the dead but not the dying, lugubrious on their perches from towers in trees where they convene like ushers on church steps. Heads sculpted to fit cane handles, claws to dibble seed, to sort out the warp of sinew from the woof, unwind the gray bobbins of brain. Assiduous as cats as they clean, wing scouring wing, until the head polished like a gem gleams, and the ears, no more than lacy holes, are sieves for passing air or molecules of gas. These birds, who wear the very face of what will last, congregating but not crowding, incurious and almost patient with their dead.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how you got to that last line. Almost patient.
That's a good question.
Very mysterious. We won't go into it. It's too mysterious. Your biographers will make a big thing out of that.
Brave Sparrow. Brave Sparrow, whose home is in the straw and baling twine threaded in the slots of a roof vent, who guards a tiny ledge against the starlings that cruise the neighborhood, whose heart is smaller than a heart should be, whose feathers stiffen like an arrow fret to quicken the hydraulics of its wings. Stay there on the metal ledge. Widen your alarming beak. But do not flee as others have to the black walnut vaulting overhead. Do not move outside the world you've made from baling twine and straw. The isolated starling fears the crows. The crows gang up to rout a hawk. The hawk is cold. And cold is what a larger heart maintains. the owl at dusk and dawn, far off, unseen, but audible, repeats its syncopated intervals, a song that's not a cry, but a whisper rising from concentric rings of water spreading out across the surface of a catchment pond. It asks, "Who are you? Who are you?" But no one knows. Stay where you are, nervous, jittery. Move your small head 100 ways, 100 times. Keep paying attention to the terrifying world. And if you see the robins in their dirty orange vests patrolling the yard like thugs, forget about the worm. Starve yourself. Or from the air, inhale the water you may need. Digest the dust. And what the promiscuous cat and jaybirds do, let them do it. Let them dart and snipe. Let them sound like others. They sleep when the owl sends out its encircling question. Stay where you are, you lit fuse, you dull spark of saltpeter and sulfur.
The voice of Michael Collier. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series has been brought to you by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C. This program is produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production is by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. We wish to thank the Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Our engineer is Brittany Mule. I'm Grace Cavalieri.